commodity prices for corn, wheat, cattle, and hogs are a concern for farmers across the country.
Yeah, it was just that first year where things tanked. I mean, the last year was good, and then it almost went straight down.
That's one Nebraska farmer, as told to Harvest Public Media reporter Grant Gerlach. We'll talk with Grant today and check in with Illinois farmers. Plus, Mexican Americans in Illinois are concerned about what may come next under President Trump.
Who's to say that we're not, you know, on his list tomorrow? It's a little scary to think that, you know, you plan your trip to Mexico and you're ready to come back, and then all of a sudden, 2 days prior, you know, he could sign an executive order saying, you know, no Mexicans allowed back in.
We check back in with Ana Nino Flores of the Cuzillo Social Club, which represents the state of Guanajuato in Mexico. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Prices for corn, crops like corn and wheat, even the value of livestock are down. And for 3 years running, farm income has dropped. While many farmers are paying more for seeds and other supplies, federal data shows that debt owed by farmers is expected to increase. We know that agriculture plays a big role in our state's economy, not just for farmers, but for manufacturing, banking, and other areas. But we also know that farming has seen booms and busts. Today on the 21st, we're going to be talking about whether Illinois agriculture is in trouble or if this is just part of a normal cycle. In a few minutes, to help us understand that, we're going to be joined by Harvest Public Media reporter Grant Gerlach and Robin Hanna, who works to understand the economic impact of ag in Illinois. But we wanted to start with two Illinois farmers. Phil Borgick owns Borgick Farm in Nokomis, about an hour south of Springfield. He raises hogs and corn for feed. And on the line from Colfax, that's about half an hour south of Bloomington, is Gerald Thompson. He owns Thompson Family Farms. Gerald farms about 3,500 acres of corn and soy. Phil, Gerald, thanks for being with me.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for being with us. Let me start with you guys. Phil, let's start with you. You know, I just talked about prices for corn, wheat, other commodities dropping. You primarily are raising hogs. Are you feeling a pinch right now?
Well, as you stated, we raise hogs. So the majority of our cost is corn and soybeans. So as corn and soybeans go up and down, then our cost structure changes, and it doesn't have any direct relationship to what we receive for our commodities. So it all depends. It depends on what day you're calling, how it affects us.
How's it looking this morning?
Today, we're back into profitability. The corn and beans have stayed stable since harvest, and so our feed costs are stable, and then the price of hogs have recovered quite a bit from the lows that we made in October. So we're back in the black.
And how much do feed costs factor into your business, Phil?
Well, 60% of our cost is feed, and 60% of that, or about 40% then of our total cost, is made up of corn. So that is the largest single ingredient cost that we have for raising pigs.
And Gerald, how about you? How are things going for you right now?
Well, so we were last year we had a really good production year. We had record yields, so we're doing okay. But if you happen to be in an area where you had average yields and then the lower crop prices that we've seen, you know, 3.5 or less for corn, you're struggling. You know, over the last three or four years or so, the cost structure has increased. So when the prices now have come back down, it's a challenge, right? I mean, you're receiving about, you know, 60% of your income that you were couple 3 years ago, and your expenses are still almost as much as they were. It makes for a challenge.
Yeah. So when you say that your expenses, when you think about that and the cost structure, what kind of expenses are we talking about? Are we talking about the price of seed? What other things are you looking at?
So I mean, from the fuel, of course, the fuel it's come down too. So that's good. You know, the equipment we buy, every time you take it to the dealer, it's expensive. You know, our fertilizer that we use, it has come down some, but not as a in relationship to the price of corn. But there has been some relief. But and then also your rents that you pay, they have not come down either, quite like the price in relation to the price. So While the prices have declined, the cost structure has declined some, but not to the point to keep up with the decline in prices.
Gerald, where does your corn go? What kind of corn are you growing?
So we are about, actually, they said south of Bloomington. We are actually east of Bloomington, and we farm in eastern McLean and in western Ford. And Gibson City, there happens to be an ethanol plant. And we have a bin site that's basically about a mile from that. So pretty much all of our corn goes to that facility just because logistically that's, when you're that close, it just makes sense. So our seed, our beans, though, actually, a lot of our beans are produced for seed. And so they go to another facility in southern or another part of the state. But so our corn goes for ethanol production.
And so, Gerald, then I imagine ethanol prices have a huge effect on what you're doing. What does that look like this year?
I actually haven't talked to the people that run the plant. Again, with the price of ethanol as with hog production, a big part of the cost of that is the corn. And since the corn prices have come down, their cost structure has come down as well. So I think they've been doing all right. I mean, they haven't been back like they were a few years ago, where they're making really big, lot more money. But I think they are in the black. They're probably very tight margins, but they are doing okay. They're continuing to operate, and the demand for ethanol has been good. They've been exports of it for that have been good to keep up for. As we become more efficient in our vehicles, we're starting to use less and less gasoline, and so that would,
Yeah, so that
the demand for
affects,
ethanol
right?
domestically would be it was is somewhat we've kind of hit a wall there. But our exports of the product have been good, so that's helped keep up with the excess.
And Gerald, you said that you had a better than average year last year. How does that work for you cyclically? Do you sort of if for farmers like yourself who had a better than average year last year, does that sort of then help tide you over for the next year? Is the next couple of years? How does that normally work?
It just depends. Again, if you go back, so that was 17, you go back 4 or 5 years, we were in an area where we were having some shorter crops and other people were having good crops. And so again, it's just, it's cyclical. And you try to, when you have some good, better times, you try to put away some for, because I've been in this business long enough to know there's ups and downs. And I think this is a tough time. I do believe up long term, we will see stabilization, and prices will continue to get back to a level where things are better. You look overall production worldwide, we've had some really good years, and the demand that we're using is such that it doesn't take much of a hiccup in any part of the world to cause us a change in the supply, which then affects price. And we've just been had 3 really good years of production, and which is really kind of unusual. And they've had some challenges down in South America, which has kind of helped keep stabilize prices this spring, which, based on our production last year, you'd have thought that prices would be lower, but because of those challenges they've had in South America, they've helped to stabilize and provide a little more opportunities that we didn't think we were going to have.
Phil, when we're talking about this, Gerald's sort of talking about things being down right now. I wonder how much w the overall, when we're talking about prices, does this affect you in terms of making big purchases? I'm thinking about equipment or new building, other investments. How are you handling that for the coming year, Phil?
Well, you have to look at the long-term profitability of your enterprises and where you think price is going to go and what the margin might be. And so our business is we can continue to grow slowly as opportunities present themselves. As Darrell talks about ethanol, a byproduct of ethanol is DDGs. And we feed a lot of DDGs in pork production and livestock in general is where those byproducts go. And so livestock growth of livestock in Illinois is important for grain farmers throughout the area because then that product can be used here, not only the corn itself, but then the byproducts coming out of ethanol.
Right. And so that's what you use. So it sounds like you use that byproduct as feed. So I know your farm, I know your office is in Raymond, your farm's in Nokomis. It's about 200 acres. How many hogs are you raising on average?
We actually raise 160,000 pigs a year. So we'll use close to 2 million bushel of either corn or corn byproducts. We actually pull byproduct DDGs out of the Gibson City plant because we have pigs in Livingston County. And we'll feed up to 30% of our ration will be ethanol or, you know, byproduct of ethanol of DDGs. So it's an important part of our ration that we're using Illinois DDGs in those rations.
And Phil, how long have you been in business? How long have you been farming?
I've been at this 35 plus years.
Senior share of ups and downs then, right?
Oh, yes. I've been definitely through the ups and downs, and I'm definitely a seasoned pork producer.
And so given that, how would you characterize, for those of us who don't know the industry as well as you, what we're seeing now?
We're seeing actually a tremendous opportunity in pork production today because we have more packing capacity coming in this fall. We have two major plants opening up, one in Coldwater, Indiana, and the other one in Sioux City, Iowa. And so we're having more demand than on the products that we, you know, we produce, the live hogs. And so that's helping our industry grow. It's we're seeing quite a bit of growth in the Midwest in pork production, several new barns going up in Indiana and Illinois and Iowa. And so it's actually an exciting time in production, pork production. And a lot of unknowns and uncertainties coming our way, but definitely a growth time and makes life interesting.
Phil, it sounds like it. And Phil, when you say that this is a growth time, are most of what you're raising, is that for export? Is that for outside of the U.S.?
We of all the pigs raised in the United States, one out of four are exported to some other country. Mexico is a big customer of ours, along with Canada, China, and Japan. And so, like corn and soybeans, we are very dependent on exports.
And I'm just curious in terms of when you guys are thinking about so much discussion in Washington about trade policies, about trade between particularly Mexico, but also when we're talking about other Asian countries. Is that something you guys think about on a daily basis, Phil? Is that something you worry about in terms of your ability to export?
Absolutely. When we're that dependent on exports, if we had to consume that product here in the United States, it would have a dramatic change in our price that we receive for our product. And so exports are very important to us on a daily basis.
Gerald, what about you?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, most of the DDGs that is produced in our ethanol plant locally is exported to Asia, and so either it's direct commodity, you know, the actual commodity, or the byproducts that we, you know, from other of the ethanol that's exported. So absolutely, exports are a huge deal for our industry, and if we had to do without them, we'd have to work on our supply side because we'd be producing way too much, right?
Well, that said, for both of you gentlemen, I wonder what you want Washington to be doing right now in terms of thinking about American trade policy. Phil, I imagine you have an opinion about that.
Oh, absolutely. We work daily. Our national organizations, both all commodity organizations, are working daily at in D.C. Trying to get more exports and making sure those channels are open. You know, now that TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, is not on the table, pushing the administration to look at bilateral, trilateral agreements so that we can continue to grow that opportunity for Illinois and for people here in the Midwest.
Yeah, Gerald, I mean, would you say that you feel like these are uncertain times, given everything we've talked about, whether it's the economy or politics, or even as you mentioned events in South America, all of this is tied in, whether it's a global economic or world event. What would you say right now, Gerald, in terms of how you feel about the future? Do you feel optimistic? Is this uncertain? What would you say?
So I started in the early 80s farming, and it was really tough and things were really tight. And so given that experience, based on what I see today, I think the future is very optimistic. We actually have a son that's getting ready to come back and start in the business. And I think when you look at his opportunities relative to mine at the time, I think they're much, much brighter. Now, having said that, are there challenges? Yes. And are they more than we've seen in the past? Probably not. But having said that, then, anything could happen in the next hour, right? But I think that things are looking optimistic. Again, there's ups and downs. This is kind of a down cycle. But, you look worldwide, there's a lot of people that are looking to increase meat in their diets. And when that happens, that's good for Illinois farmers and farmers in America in general. So, no, I think things are good. But there are challenges. And do I lay awake at night worrying about them? No, that's just kind of part of agriculture.
Yeah. Well, it's great news that your son is coming back to work on the family farm as well. I know that's always been a challenge for especially this generation of farming. Phil, we're almost out of time, but question for you. You optimistic about the future?
Absolutely. You can't be in livestock production or grain production and not be optimistic about the future and the opportunities that it presents. When you're depending on the next big rain, you got to have faith in the Lord and in your abilities to produce.
Well, I want to thank both of you gentlemen for taking the time out of your day to speak with us. Phil Borgic, owner of Borgic Farms in Montgomery County, Gerald Thompson, Thompson Family Farms in Colfax. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're focusing a little bit on Illinois' agricultural economy this morning. We're just talking to two different farmers, one hog farmer, one grain farmer, hearing about prices being down, the cost of doing business up. We're talking about that cycle. And here to help us understand the bigger picture are Robin, Hannah, and Grant Gerlach. Robin is a project manager for the Rural Economic Assistance Center with the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University. Grant Gerlach is a reporter with Harvest Public Media. He's based out in Lincoln, Nebraska. Robin, Grant, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thank you.
Robin, let's start with you. Just from hearing Phil and Gerald talking about grain and hogs, what they're farming, is what we just heard typical in Illinois right now?
Yes, I'd say so. The agriculture, the corn production area of agriculture in Illinois is huge, and I think it's valuable to have the input of two gentlemen, but there's also it's a much larger environment. Say, for example, the total value of corn produced in Illinois was just about $8 billion in 2016.
Yeah, and Grant, I wonder what you think. Like, what do you think when you just heard Phil and Gerald's story? You were talking to farmers all across the Midwest. How common is what they just said? How common is that sentiment?
Well, I think it is common. When you reach out to farmers, you often hear just a lot of optimism, but that's not without some challenges that they face. One thing I think you heard from them is the value of having been in the farming business for a few decades and having experience, as each of them did, with previous downturns.
And I wonder also when we think about the size of what they're doing, Phil talking to us about 160,000 hogs, I think he said, Gerald farming about 3,500 acres of corn and soy. Grant, are we seeing a difference in how, depending on the size of the farm, how farmers across the Midwest are able to absorb what they're facing right now?
Yeah, I think in some cases, yes. Part of that depends, again, on how long they've been doing it. If they've recently expanded to that kind of size, maybe while things were really expensive, while land was really expensive, if they expanded by 1,000 acres in that period of time, then they've got a whole lot of debt on hand that now they need to find a way to pay for, but they have less money coming in to do it. So timing is a big part of it. There were, when I talked to farm economists, one of the groups that they say is more threatened in this time period are those farmers who expanded quickly when times were good. So they bought high, and now prices are low, and that's the challenge they face.
Robin, I wonder if you can help us understand, why are prices for commodities low right now? That's a big question. I know there's a lot of different things that go into that.
Well, there's a lot of it out there. That's probably the best answer. We've had several years of really record production, and when you have a lot of it, the price drops. If there's not the demand the demand for the product.
And are we just not seeing that much demand? I assume you're talking about international demand versus maybe domestic demand for.
No, there's a demand for a product, for the product, but it's just relative to the supply that we have right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Grit, when we think about that, I want to just focus on the grain industry for a minute, because we've seen different stories about how the grain industry is being driven out of business. Do you think that's accurate to talk about that happening here in the Midwest in certain places?
Well, driven out of business is a relative term. There may be some farmers who can't compete in the current sort of low-price environment, but that land will still be farmed by someone. That land isn't going to go out of production if it's reasonable to farm it and to raise a crop on it. So one of the questions is, how many farms will there be? And that's one of the trends that we'll continue to watch as these low prices sort of play out. There recently, the numbers for 2016 came out from USDA earlier this week or last week. And in Illinois, the number of farms decreased by about 1,200. And most of those were small farms that went away, but about 400 of those were mid-sized farms that they don't break it out this way, but those could be grain farms that didn't make it over the past year. So most of that land would still be in farms. The average size of a farm, though, increased. So that's a trend that's been going on a long time, where the number of farms is decreasing and the size of farms on average is increasing. So that's part of the question, is just who will be able to afford to continue farming?
And can we talk about, Grant, for a minute, farmland? Because I know years ago we were seeing kind of crazy record prices. I'm thinking particularly in Iowa, but certainly also here in Illinois, of the price of farmland. Has that come down now also?
It's definitely started to come down. So the Chicago Fed recently looked at how land prices have changed from their peak values, and the Chicago Fed covers the northern part of Illinois. And since the peak in 2013, the Fed says that farmland in Illinois has lost 11% of its value. Now, 11% is not as much as some other states, but if you're thinking about a farm that was going for $10,000 per acre and now is going for $9,000 per acre, and the amount of value across a whole farm that could represent, it starts to add up.
Yeah, and I wonder how that plays into this equation you're talking about as well, of sort of a consolidation of smaller farms and the idea that we're seeing fewer and fewer farms. Obviously, that's a trend that that everyone kind of knows about. How do you think that the price of farmland, it's interesting to me because it would seem that if the price of farmland is going down, that would make it easier for people to get into the industry. But I guess there are a lot of other factors going on there, Grant.
Well, and it's still very high. So in 2016, the numbers for Illinois were farmland was around $7,500 per acre on average. And back in 2010, it was around $5,000 per acre. So it's still much higher than it was even in recent history. and expensive to buy if you're a new farmer.
Yeah, for sure. And how does that compare, though? Because I know at its peak in Iowa, we're seeing things like crazy things like 10,000 or more an acre, right? So how does Illinois farmland compare when we're looking at other states?
Well, I think in certain parts of Illinois, it's right up there with those high prices that you see in Iowa. When you get to that level, it just varies farm to farm,
mm-hmm.
and who's around to buy it. Most farmland does go to other farmers. Farmers are most likely the people who buy farmland. And when you get to that level, it comes down to who's got the money in that local area and who wants it. So you see sometimes those anecdotal reports of very high prices. But in general, you know, when you compare states like Iowa and Illinois, it's pretty close.
That's Grant Gerlach. He's a reporter with Harvest Public Media, talking to us from Lincoln, Nebraska, where he's based. Also on the line with us, we're from Western Illinois University. We're speaking with Robin Hanna. He's the project manager with the Rural Economic Assistance Center with the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs. You know, Robin, as we're talking about all of this, the price of farmland, what we heard from the two farmers we were talking to earlier, from Phil and from Gerald, you know, I asked them about big purchases, and they also were talking about how expensive equipment is, not just seed prices, but equipment, fuel prices. What is sort of the ripple effect of what we've seen here in Illinois? What have you seen this year with other prices? Are we seeing that sort of having to have an impact on other parts of the economy?
Yes. Yes, you are. The one of the issues is when you have a farm operation, your costs are pretty fixed, and so the variation that you have in terms of spending comes down to what you spend on what your discretionary spending is in terms of equipment, in terms of maintenance, and in terms of household spending. One of the issues with farms is the farm income is so low that many of the farms are relying on off-farm income.
And by that, what do you mean by off-farm income? You meaning they just have other jobs?
Well, the farmer may have other jobs. There's earned income, which is where the farmer or the spouse or the children have other jobs. Or there's unearned, and that's a range of income, interest, dividends, Social Security, other public programs. But without that, many of these farms could not, many of the farm operations could not continue in their present sense.
Mm-hmm. Grant, how much should we see that? Is that, you know, what Robin's saying about farmers? Maybe, you know, I think we have perhaps those of us who are not in the industry maybe think a farmer, we have sort of a sense of a farm where there's a farmer. We probably think of a small or medium-sized farm and that they're, all of their livelihood is coming from that. What Robin's saying, is it probably a more accurate picture that farmers maybe have other income, other jobs, especially when we're talking about a small to medium-sized farm?
Yeah, those second jobs are very common, and as you mentioned, especially for spouses to work off-farm. That's how a lot of farm families work out their health insurance, for instance. It's expensive to buy it on your own. If you think of a farm as a small business, to buy your own health insurance. And so one of them will get a job in town or somewhere where they can get health insurance that way. But as he said, farms don't have enough oftentimes now to pay that kind of income to a family, so they have to find another way to get it. And that's where, you know, the kinds of job opportunities that are available in rural areas become very important. Are there jobs there for people who need them?
And I mean, I think about when we, Grant, especially, I imagine all of this, everything we've talked about, makes the idea of starting a farm, and we think about younger generations of farmers, it sounds like a really daunting prospect when we talk about everything that we've seen in the past year or two.
Well, if you're starting at ground zero, you don't have any land, you don't have any equipment, that's a really, really tough prospect.
And does that happen? Are people still doing that?
Well, yes, but more often they're looking at a smaller enterprise that they're going to start, where the startup costs may be smaller up front. Or they have that second job already. They're going to dip their toe into farming by finding a little bit of land, a little bit of equipment, and try to build it up over time. But just saying, I'm going to be a farmer and I'm going to get everything up front, man, that's a tall order for sure.
Mm-hmm. And it was nice to hear Gerald talking about his son coming back and going to take over the business. How much of that is an issue as well with older farmers having a next generation that wants to take over the business?
Well, that's a major issue with farmers. Oftentimes, even just opening that up to the next generation and involving them in decisions and involving them in the business and giving them that kind of perspective that may attract them back to the farm and then give them the kind of background that they need to be successful if they're going to eventually take over the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And there are organizations all over the Midwest trying to encourage farmers to start those conversations early and to try to form those relationships. If it's not with a son or a daughter, then to start a relationship with another young person who's interested in farming, to try to establish that kind of not only mentorship, but that kind of business transition that can make that a smooth transition.
Our friend Todd Gleason is tweeting at us as we're having this conversation, pointing out the average income for a grain farmer in Illinois in 2015 was $500. Thanks, Todd, for that. And Grant, as we wrap up this, Grant and Robin, I wanted to ask both of you just sort of a final question about, you know, what I talked to Phil and Gerald about as we're sort of seeing this down cycle. Is this something, Robin, let's start with you. Do you think this is a down cycle? Do you think this is part of a normal cycle? Do you think that people should be worried about agriculture in Illinois?
No, I really don't. When you look at Illinois and drive across the state and north to south, what you see are fields. And these fields are going to be there and they're going to be planted. And as Grant said, depends on who's doing it. But the production of the product is going to remain. What the concern is the population in the rural areas that are supported by agriculture, will there be the labor involved, labor required? Will there be the jobs for the supporting family income? Will there be the institutions in the communities to support
mm-hmm.
them? And that's a concern.
Grant, how should folks outside the industry be thinking about this as they're sort of paying attention to maybe, is this something, do you think people should be, consumers should be worried about higher food prices? Where do you think we're at?
No, I don't think higher food prices are necessarily a concern, but it's a matter of the condition of the communities where your food comes from. And if you're concerned about where your food comes from, you should be concerned about the people who produce it. And the kind of life they're able to make for themselves and for their families. So there's a significant amount of stress happening in farm country. It's hard to nail down right now exactly how bad or how serious it is. So it's bad. It's been getting incrementally worse, but it's been a lot worse before. So it's somewhere in that range of concern. So overall, the farm industry will continue. It's just what happens to these farm businesses, and that becomes a very case-by-case basis. But for these farmers with a lot of debt or for these new farmers, there are a lot of challenges out there.
Sounds like it. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for that. Grant Gerlach, a reporter with Harvest Public Media, Robin Hanna with Western Illinois University. Thanks, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I'm Nyla Boodoo, and this is The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. Throughout his campaign and into his presidency, President Trump pledged to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, also deport millions of immigrants who are here illegally. In fact, this morning, the Department of Homeland Security has released two memos that expand its power for detaining and deporting more immigrants who are here in the U.S. illegally. Yesterday afternoon, we spoke with Anya Nino Flores. She's a member of the Cuxillo Social Club, which represents the state of Guanajuato in Mexico. Anya, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anya, last time we spoke with you, we were talking about a program, the Abuelitos program, which was initiated by former Senator Mark Kirk more than a decade ago, and it allowed people in the U.S. with family members in Mexico to apply for 30-day visas to be able to visit. And we talked about your social club, which does a lot of work going back and forth, where many of your members are from. I wonder, how have people in the group been feeling about the first few weeks of President Trump being in the White House?
Well, I mean, it was, first of all, I think it was not only a shock to us as a group, but I think it was a shock to many people that he actually won the presidency. And I mean, we are unsure as to what's going to happen, really. We don't really know what direction he's taking. And I think he's trying to be consistent a little bit with what he's saying, but at the same time, there's a lot of uncertainty. So a lot of the members from our group, as well, I think a lot of the community from Mexico, we're concerned, I mean, as to what's going on, and in a sense, fearful, because there's so much uncertainty with this campaign.
Anya, can you remind us about the Cuxillo Social Club, what your group is all about?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're a social club that is formed by individuals from our hometown, back from Guanajuato. And we pretty much get together and we do like fundraisers to help our community back home. So we have a direct impact with our community back in Mexico. And, you know, that's like our sole purpose in a sense. And it's a nice way to kind of keep that community feeling here in the U.S. And also, as you had mentioned, we also participated in the Abuelita programs before, started in 2011. So that was a big chunk of what we used to do before, kind of provide the ability for other families to request, you know, their grandparents and parents to come and visit them here in the state of Illinois for at least 30 days.
Now, I know there's probably no word yet on what's going to happen with the Abuelitos program, but I know that when we think about the executive order on immigration that President Trump put in place several weeks ago, of course, now that travel ban has been overturned, it didn't mention Mexico, but does news of that make Mexican-American families, are they nervous about immigration and people traveling back and forth between Mexico and the U.S.?
You know, personally, I have to say yes. I think the community as a whole, we are fearful. I mean, we're a big group, but so are, you know, all these different families that have been affected by the executive order he put in place. So just like they, you know, they got hit with this executive order, I think any group, it could be next. You know, it's not just, I think he's targeting specific groups, but who's to say that we're not, you know, on his list tomorrow or, you know, year two of his presidency. It's kind of, you know, it's unsure because a lot of our communities, a lot of our families, they're residents or they're citizens, but, you know, they fly back and forth from Mexico all the time. So it's a little scary to think that, you know, you plan your trip to Mexico and you're ready to come back. And then all of a sudden, two days prior, you know, he could sign an executive order saying, you know, no Mexicans allowed back in. So it's definitely something that he could do. And we're kind of, you know, he's doing it. So there's some fear.
Anya, do you yourself have a lot of family still back in Guanajuato?
I do. I have half of my family back home.
And so how often are you traveling back and forth?
Actually, I don't travel that often, but I did travel recently this past December, and it was, you know, it was eye-opening. You really get to see, you know, why our families, you know, make the decision to come to the U.S., you know, to seek work. You know, it's very scarce. It's very, there's a little bit of work, and it's, you know, I visited areas with very poor, poor communities, and it's, you know, it's a different world. It's different. So it's tough.
Anya, what is your family in Mexico? What do they think about all of this?
I think they're scared for us. I think that, one, you know, we have, you know, those that are very skeptical, and they're like, no, President Trump won't be able to, you know, do much. You know, there's a balance in the in the system here in the United States, you know, in terms of the president and Congress. And they're kind of hopeful that everything will kind of equal out and there will be some balance and not all the decision making will be on his behalf. So I think, you know, they're kind of thinking about that. But at the same time, you know, I think they're very supportive, our families back home. And, if President Trump decides to say, you know, we're going to not permit more Mexicans to come into the U.S. or deport a lot of our fellow Mexicans back to Mexico, I think that we're being a strong community. And I think we're supporting one another.
I know, Ana, one of the key elements of the Cuzio Social Club is service projects. And you were just talking about where your family is from, Guanajuato, sort of areas where there aren't as much, as you're saying, there's definitely not as much economic opportunity for people. What kind of projects are, I know that the whole point of the Social Club is not just travel, but to help finance infrastructure and other things to help where you all are from and where your families are from in Mexico. What kind of things are you, what projects are you all working on your social club right now?
Currently we want to propose doing two projects, and they're kind of small, but I mean, we're still meeting up with the different leaders of our group to kind of propose different things, but we get to participate. Being a social club, we get to participate in a program called 3-for-1. This is a program that's sponsored by the Mexican government, and different parties take place in order to finance these projects. And one of the projects that we want to work on and are interested in introducing is trying to see if we can introduce the usage of solar panels in our community. Some were distributed prior a couple years ago to some families within our community, and we've seen that it's a high success. And these solar panels are directly tied to the water system in our homes, so they're used to generate heat, and that eliminates the need to buy a lot of gas, which sometimes can be really expensive, especially for certain families that are very low income within our community. So that's one of the projects, and we also are hoping to possibly introduce or propose for doing the pavement of a small road in our community. I mean, some are paved and some aren't, you know, still dirt and gravel. So we have those two different ideas that we want to introduce and see if we can get funding for and hopefully, you know, make it happen.
Ana, are folks in the social club, are they talking about, I don't know if other people, in addition to all of this, these social projects they're doing in Mexico, are you finding that some people in the social club or other people in the Mexican-American community are turning to activism to speak out against President Trump?
I think so. I mean, I won't be able to identify any of the people within our immediate community have, but I mean, it's kind of split. You know, one of the things that I'm noticing is that I think it depends a lot. You know, if I think those that are more stable here, and I'm saying so in terms of their status, they are, I think, more willing to go out and protest and, you know, be active, which I think is important. And, you know, not just going out on the streets is a way to be active and, you know, speaking out. But I think for the community that is undocumented, I think there's a little bit more fear, just because you don't, you know, if you have a job and you're undocumented, I'm assuming it's very hard for you to get another job, you know, and there's kind of like this dividing line in a sense. I think that we're all really kind of standing together and kind of pushing through and supporting each other with this, just because, again, just there's a huge uncertainty with President Trump's, you know, his presidency. So we don't really know what's going on. And some of the things that he's doing and taking action upon, we just completely disagree with.
What do you want people in Illinois to know? You're from East Aurora, right? And we're talking about the particular ties between one Illinois community and one community in Guanajuato in that Mexican state. What do you want people to know about the ties between Illinois and Mexico?
There's a strong representation of the Mexican community here in the state of Illinois. And I think as a community, we're really proud, you know, to be here. So many people from the state of Guanajuato, we reside within the state of Illinois, you know, or we're fellow Chicagoans, or we live in the suburbs. So we're really proud to be here to represent Illinois and just to, you know, make it a better state, if anything, with our with our work and whatnot. So there's a strong tie.
Mm-hmm. What would you like to see from the Trump administration going forward?
I would hope, you know, that, man, it's a tough question, just because I hope that he can just be a leader by example and, you know, actually promote the well-being of all, not just a selected group, and to base his decisions based on in terms if they're fair or not, and just to not wholeheartedly kind of discriminate or set aside certain groups and bands. And I think that's we are supposed to move forward, not move backwards. So I would hope that you know, history is taken into account in terms of moving towards a better direction instead of you know, going backwards in a sense.
It's Ana Nino Flores. She's a member of the Kutsiyu Social Club from East Aurora. That Kutsiyu Social Club represents the state of Guanajuato in Mexico. Ana, thanks for taking the time to talk with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, this morning, the Department of Homeland Security has released two new memos expanding its power for detaining and deporting more immigrants who are here in the U.S. illegally. Stay tuned to NPR News. We're going to have the latest on that coming up in the news updates as well as later on throughout the day. That about does it for us today. On tomorrow's program, we're going to be speaking with Rebecca Ozaki. She's the daughter of two Japanese Americans who, 75 years ago, were held in internment camps after Executive Order 9066 was signed by President Roosevelt and was following the attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese during World War II. Here's a clip of Rebecca's late grandfather, Sam Ozaki, explaining to the Center for Arkansas History and Culture about what conditions were like for him at the Jerome Relocation Center in Arkansas.
There were a few families there before us, but arriving there by train and then getting off, and you just see a lot of unfinished barracks, mud all over the place, and people finally showed us where we were to go and finally settled in there. But it was just a totally different kind of setting from sunny Southern California. And I remember saying that the total disappointment. All the years we have attended school, we had learned about this great democracy, this great constitution, and it was such a disappointment that it really did not exist. As former Chief Justice Evan Hughes says, the constitution is just a piece of paper, and that's all it really was. Although if you have a vigilant community, citizenry, well-informed, then, of course, that Constitution can be a living instrument. But at that time, it was just a piece of paper to me.
That's Sam Ozaki. He actually went on to become Chicago's first Asian-American principal in Chicago public schools. He passed away in 2015 at the age of 90. Tomorrow, we're going to be speaking with his granddaughter, Rebecca Ozaki. She serves on the Chicago chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League. She's in Urbana's talking to people on campus about the impact of her father, his experience, the experience of more than 100,000 Japanese Americans who were incarcerated during World War II. That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us via phone. If you want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, follow us on social media is at our website, 21stshow.org. A note about our social media, our Twitter handle is 21st Show. That's 21st Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest Illinois news. And if you you search for our Facebook page to like us. You can comment on what we're working on, post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help from Steve Mork, and Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.